The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome this morning students here with our Court with Class program, which is sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court. It's a national award-winning program in which high school students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. They're given materials about the case. They may have discussed the case with counsel. And at noon, they will talk with a justice of this court. So we have with us Fort Atkinson High School students. Would they please stand? Ooh. Well, welcome. A large group, 50 according to my notes. You may be seated, please. And we're also welcoming today students, fourth grade students from Glen Park Elementary School in New Berlin, and they are here and visiting with their representative, Representative Gundrum. And with our fourth graders, please stand. Well, we're delighted to welcome you, and you are the first of a series of fourth graders who are going to come to this this oral argument. You may be seated. And then they are going to leave in an assigned time, and another group of fourth graders will enter. So if you hear movement behind you, counsel, it is the fourth graders, and I'm sure that will not disturb your argument here, and we're delighted to welcome them. Now that we've met all of you, let me introduce the court. I'm going to start on my far right with Justice David Prosser, and he is the justice with whom you will meet at noon. Anyone else in the courtroom who would like to attend the noon session is welcome to do so. Seated next to Justice Prosser is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Seated to my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox. To his left, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, we'll call the second case, 01-2690CR, State v. Patty Jorgensen. Arguing on behalf of Ms. Jorgensen is Charles B. Vetzner, Assistant State Public Defender. Mr. Vetzner.
Thank you. May it please the Court. This case concerns the validity of different sentencing guidelines for certain drunk driving cases in different sections of the state. Having said that, I want to stress three things that I think this case is not about. First of all, I don't think that this case involves a general challenge to the concept of sentencing guidelines. I think it's important to emphasize that point because, as you know, we've just recently embarked on a new set of felony sentencing guidelines. I don't think there's anything about the argument that I'm presenting today that in any way would bear on the validity of these new guidelines. I've looked at those new guidelines, and there's nothing that I see there that in any way suggests that judges in different administrative districts or in different counties should apply those guidelines differently, and certainly there's nothing that suggests that there are different guidelines in different portions of the state.
These are temporary guidelines statewide?
Yes.
Okay.
But at least as far as we've gotten, I see nothing about the argument that's presented today that would bear on those felony guidelines.
Does it make any difference, and just jumping in here, guidelines are guidelines. They're discretionary. It's something the court takes into consideration, among other factors. Does that make any difference that they're discretionary? A court can do, as in this case, and go over or under?
Well, at some level, it potentially could, I suppose, to say that this doesn't really necessarily result in different sentences in different portions of the state. However, the state's argument is essentially an endorsement of what might be viewed as a companion case to the one here today, and that's State versus Smart. The decision in State versus Smart recognized, just as a practical matter, that having different guidelines in different portions of the state was going to result in different sentences. I'd refer to paragraph 4 of the Smart decision, which is reproduced in the state's appendix at page 132 of its appendix, where the Smart court said,
Is that referring to this court, or what court are you talking about? That was a joke. I mean, the Smart court. Sorry, counsel.
You should know that when you're up arguing, except for your own jokes, people arguing have very little sense of humor.
I humbly apologize. I'm sorry.
The decision states in that paragraph 4, as noted, the Ninth District's jail time guideline for Smart's offense is 120 days, except between certain dates. Had he been convicted of the same crime in other judicial districts, Smart would have likely received a much shorter jail term. In the 10th District, the guideline is 110 days, in the 8th, 75 days, in the 4th, 45 days. Smart is arguing that this disparity violates his constitutional rights. So I think you could say that it's not, we're not quite in the same situation we would be had there been a provision that in County X the penalty is 3 months to a year, and in County Y or in District Y the penalty is 5 months to 2 years. But I think as a practical matter, the fact of having different guidelines means that there are going to be different sentences. After all, if these guidelines weren't created, well, what's the point of having the guidelines if the judge isn't at least going to consider them? And in this particular case,
well, it's to talk about sentencing disparity. It's to talk about some consistency and to take into consideration. I mean, it's the same when we had the. Before we had truth in sentencing, we had the statewide sentencing guidelines, and basically it was a tool for the judges to take a look at, to consider when they used their discretion. It was a statewide tool.
That's right, and in fact, at that point, the statute provided then is, I think, the new statutory framework for guidelines provide that the judge shall consider the guideline in imposing
shall consider, sentence. But he didn't have to take them into account, he or she. In other words, it was simply that he or she would use the guideline, but he could go under, over, above, whatever. It was strictly up to the judge how he wanted to sentence that person, and that was in the prior guidelines. He only had to refer to them, he or she.
The judge did not have to sentence according to the guideline,
that's
and I
correct.
Think that's I think that's true in regard to the guidelines that are being challenged here.
Yes.
My position is that the judges, certainly in this case and in the Smart decision, I won't say the Smart court to replicate where we were before, in the Smart decision, considered the guidelines, and the guidelines influenced where the sentence came out. I think for this court to say the problem that I'm complaining about doesn't exist because the judges are not required to impose a sentence consistent with those localized guidelines is really to ignore the problem, with all due respect. I think if the court feels that my argument is incorrect, the court should say these guidelines are fine. I don't think that the real solution here is to say that they're not mandatory to impose a particular sentence.
Mr. Vetsman, you had three things this case is not about. It's not about the validity of sentencing. What are the other two, rapidly?
One of them rapidly is that it's not about an argument that sentences must be uniform. It's not an argument that my client was entitled to receive this precisely the same sentence as as either a defendant within the same guideline area or the same sentence as somebody under in some other section of the state. The third thing that this case is not about, and this is one that I think bears some time, is that in my view, this case is not about the validity of the Wisconsin statute that mandated some type of local guidelines. And I'm referring, of course, to Wisconsin Statute 346.65, parent 2M, parent A. And to me, that's really the nub of the dispute between me on one side, or my client on one side, and the Court of Appeals and the state on the other.
Mr. Vestner, let me, if I might, go back to what I consider at least to be the first issue in this case, and that's one of standing. As you know, the state has said this is a situation where you're attacking the provision, at least as applied, that the statute refers to 346.631B, that your client was convicted and sentenced under 346.631A, operating while under the influence rather than the BAC approach. How do you have standing? I think that's the place that I'd like to see you address, at least before you get into your other arguments.
Well, the state's argument essentially is that the trial judge in this case erred in relying on the guidelines at all. And therefore, the state is essentially arguing that there should be resentencing without reliance on the guidelines. I am not going to object to that approach because that would provide the relief that I desire. And if this court indicates that's where it is, I can just we can skip all the colored lights and I can sit down, because that's all I'm asking for in this case is to have resentencing without reliance on the guidelines.
What's the matter with that? Why don't you take it?
Pardon me?
Why don't you take that?
Well, I'm willing to take it. I have philosophically or intellectually or whatever, I have some problem with whether or not that's the correct approach, but I am willing to take that. The concern I have is if the guidelines on their face are valid, I'm not sure that there's anything wrong with the trial judge in a sub 1A case considering the guidelines, which on their face apply to 1B. And in fact, to the extent that the state is arguing that this whole guideline system is perfectly fine because it reduces sentencing disparity, it seems to me that their argument has a logical glitch in it if you say that the guidelines only apply to 1B, because it doesn't make any sense where you have these alternative bases for getting an operated a drunk driving conviction to say we have this elaborate system of guidelines in various parts of the state to supposedly reduce disparity when there's a conviction under 1B, the prohibited blood alcohol content.
I don't think you've really answered my question. How do you get standing? What gives you standing, given the concession of the state and given your position?
What gives me standing is that the court relied on these guidelines, and I'm challenging the validity of the guidelines.
At least to some extent, the court relied on the guidelines?
Well, I think the court relied on the guidelines to a great extent. There is some language in the trial court's decision saying that I didn't rely on the guidelines in their entirety. But if you look at what the trial court said, it really is apparent that that's all the court did rely on. The court said that aside from the guidelines, it was relying on three things: blood alcohol content, the number of prior convictions, and the bad driving that was involved in this case. Now, if you were to look at the guideline that the court at least considered, that, at least acknowledged it was considering, and that's reproduced at appendix page 133 of my blue brief.
Well, I'm having a very difficult time understanding, I guess maybe the importance of this case. If the judge, if let's say that you get what you want, and it goes back for sentencing not considering the guidelines, not relying on the guidelines. So then the judge says, okay, I can't rely on the guidelines because those guidelines apply only to, what is it, 1B?
Correct.
Okay. But I'm going to, I can't shut my mind from them because the legislature or the judges or whomever set this these guidelines up have said that this is an appropriate penalty for a 1A. And given the similarities between 1A and 1A and 1B, I will at least keep them in mind when I'm sentencing on 1A only. Is he making error there?
Well, the reason why I'm here is because I'm arguing that the whole guideline system is invalid and that the court should not be able to be if they're stricken down, the court is not going to be considering these guidelines at all. Now, what I'm saying that the court should what should be created is a list of aggravating and mitigating factors, which is what the statute actually mandates the chief judge of each administrative district to create. But
Mr. Vestner, you're not. I guess my underlying assumption is that we find no due process or equal protection violation with these guidelines as they are. So we just send it back for resentencing under 1B, under 1A. And then the judge at that time says he says, okay, I can't rely on these guidelines for this because he's convicted of 1A. But I'm going to look at them because this is what people are doing for a violation of 1B, and that's a very similar crime to 1A. Is he in the error? Is he relying on those guidelines?
If the court, it would not be my position that it would be appropriate for the court to send the case back for resentencing to where it would consider but not expressly rely on the guidelines. I'm asking the court to do one of two. Well, I'm asking the court to do one particular thing, that is to invalidate the guideline and then send it back for resentencing without the guideline. If the court wants to say these guidelines only apply to blood alcohol concentration cases, and that the court shouldn't be using them for the under the influence cases, even though that's not my argument, I don't see how I have standing to complain about that, because that gets me in terms of what I'm not aggrieved by that type of ruling. But I'd like to come back to one other thing that you said in the course of your question.
Okay.
And that is, you said, assuming the court doesn't find the guidelines to be unconstitutional. I think part of the reason it's important to consider my argument that the statute in question didn't mandate this type of sentencing guidelines is because it does present some additional concerns that I think this court should address in this particular case. In a traditional approach, a court usually doesn't reach the constitutional issue until it resolves the other issues. The validity of the statute as a matter of the Constitution is usually the last issue the court reaches. Unfortunately, to denigrate my own performance in this case, I don't think I developed those other arguments in precisely that way. But it seems to me, first of all, if there's a question as to whether or not the statute authorizes sentencing guidelines as opposed to just a list of aggravating and mitigating factors, it raises a question as to whether or not these guidelines violate the state statute. And in preparing for the argument today, I came across a case that I think presented a somewhat similar situation. a case called Demuth versus Wisconsin Judicial Conference, 166 Wis. 2nd. In that case, it was argued that there was a state statute that mandated not the chief judge of the administrative district, but the Wisconsin Judicial Conference to develop uniform bail schedules that were individualized. And the argument was that the uniform bail schedule that the Judicial Conference developed was not individualized as mandated by the statute. And this court, even though this court is part of the Wisconsin Judicial Conference, concluded that that argument was correct, that the statute was not actually complied with by the Wisconsin Judicial Conference, and it invalidated those particular guidelines, the bail guidelines in that instance. And I think we have the same situation here. We have a statute that says, first of all, the judges are supposed to consider blood alcohol content. And then it says the chief judge of each administrative district should develop a guideline of aggravating and mitigating factors. It doesn't say anything about developing sentencing guidelines for proposing sentences. And as I noted in my brief, at the very time the legislature wrote this language, it already had created our old version of felony sentencing guidelines. And if you look at the language that the legislature promulgated to develop those sentencing guidelines, it talked about, and this was in old 973.011 sub 1, and I quoted it in the brief, that the rules for the sentencing guidelines, quote, shall set forth the methodology for calculating recommended sentence lengths. There's nothing similar about a language talking about calculating recommended sentence lengths with language talking about aggravating and mitigating factors.
Mr. Vetzner, the statute talks about the blood alcohol level. And I suppose that could be an aggravating factor.
Or mitigating, probably, but I agree. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Well, there is a certain threshold. Give me an example of how guidelines would consider blood alcohol level as an aggravating factor.
Well, the existing guidelines, to that extent, do comply with that. If you're to look at the guideline that was used by the trial judge in this case, as well as the guidelines in the 4th and 8th Judicial Administrative Districts, all of those use blood alcohol content as aggravating factors, and I'm referring to pages 131 through pages 133 of my appendix, that there's little grids, and the grids on the vertical scale, the vertical scale is based on blood alcohol content. The horizontal scale is based on the degree of bad driving. So it's to the extent that these guidelines are considering blood alcohol level, I would agree that it's valid, that by developing it this way for blood alcohol content, the court has complied with the administrative court judges have complied with the provision for blood alcohol level to be a factor in sentencing.
Well, is it inappropriate to link the scale with an actual proposed sentence?
I think it is. I think that because there's no authorization to do that.
Well, how would you do it if you didn't link it to a sentence? You have a scale. It doesn't take a scale to say that a 0.15 is less than a 0.20 and then 0.25 is more. I mean, you don't need...
Well, In answer to your question of how would you do it, I think the way you would do it is the way at least some of the districts did it in addition to these grids, and that was the appendix that I produced in my reply brief, where two of the administrative districts developed independent of their grids with recommended sentences, they developed lists of aggravating factors and lists of mitigating factors that the judge should consider. It would seem to me that those particular lists of aggravating and mitigating factors would be consistent not only with the letter of the statutes, of the statute that's involved in this case, but the legislative history that I tried to delineate in my brief, where the legislature, after thinking of various ways to address this, ultimately decided that we shouldn't refer this to the Sentencing Commission, but we should come up with some type of general approach to consider aggravating and mitigating factors. And I would submit that a list of aggravating and mitigating factors is complying directly with that. And, Justice Prosser, in terms of your question about what's wrong is with having these proposed recommended sentences, I would refer the Court back to its own prior history in terms of sentencing guidelines. The prior version of the felony sentencing guidelines, when the legislature said, we're going to have sentencing guidelines one way or another, the Court can either take control of it or the legislature is going to take control of it. And this Court decided that it wasn't going to take control of it, that the fact that different judges in different or the same judge in different cases imposed different sentences didn't mean that there was some type of invalid disparity in sentencing, that the judges were appropriately considering the three basic sentencing factors, the seriousness of the offense, protection of the community, and the character of the offender. And in the decision of this Court at 120 with second in re felony sentencing guidelines, the Court said that it was inappropriate for this Court to develop recommended sentences. And I would submit, if this Court decided that it was inappropriate to develop proposed sentences, I don't see where the chief judge of each administrative district would have any greater authority to come up with an actual proposed sentence that would theoretically be followed by the other judges in that particular administrative district.
Counsel, I just wanted to state two things. One, you said that they decided not to send it to the Sentencing Commission. Of course, the only Sentencing Commission that existed was the Felony Sentencing Commission. And the other thing, and I stood where you are probably back in 1984 and made the argument to this Court that they ought to accept it. And I think it was
8-0.
It was 7-0 against doing it, so that was so much for my argument. But
it was a smart Court.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't disagree, but then, of course, the legislature then went on their own and created the Sentencing Commission, which as I served on from 84 to 92. So I just wanted to indicate to you that this was not a choice that the legislature had any sentencing commission to send it to. They just did it on their own. There wasn't any commission because it was handling, these are definitely different than the felony sentencing.
Well, in answer to your first point about how these cases could have been in front of the Sentencing Commission, in my brief at page 11 through 13, I had discussed the legislative history that resulted in the statute that we're grappling with today. And I noted that at one point there was a proposal as part of this legislative process for this statute to amend the language to provide that the Sentencing Commission would not only develop guidelines for felony cases, but also for misdemeanor drunk driving cases. and it was decided not to do that. It was thought that it would create too many problems. I see that my red light is on.
I wanted to raise a question with you in that in re felony sentencing. Wasn't you said it's inappropriate for the court to do it? Was that a separation of powers argument, that it was legislative and not judicial?
No. I believe the court just I believe that you dissented in that particular decision, and Justice Bablich concurred. I think that you're the only two justices left from that opinion at 120 with second.
Other than counsel, Justice Wilkins.
Correct.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. We have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Vetster. Mr. Wren, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Christopher Wren. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I appear on behalf of the respondent state of Wisconsin. I want to go to a couple of things that came up during Mr. Vetzner's argument. I want to deal with Justice Crook's question about standing. I think that Ms. Jorgensen does not have standing to raise the constitutional issue based on just the fact that the legislature said that as a matter of statute in the statutes that the guidelines should apply only to should mandatorily apply only to the provision of the drunk driving statutes that she was not sentenced under. When I say mandatorily apply, I don't mean that the trial court would have to follow the guidelines. It's just that to the extent that the courts have any obligation to consider the guidelines, they only had an obligation under Section 1B, not Section 1A. She does have standing to raise the statutory violation, which is what's going on here, I think. And our position is that she's right, that the court probably considered the guidelines, thinking it had to consider the guidelines. And under those circumstances, I don't think it's the state's position or that it's appropriate for the court itself to try to second guess what the trial judge would have done if it had had a correct understanding of the law. So we're perfectly happy to have this case disposed of by having the sentence vacated and remanded back to the trial court.
Can't we just, rather than dispose of it that way and essentially make this whole exercise somewhat meaningless, can't we simply say that 346.65 does not apply to 2B?
It does not apply on its face to 1A.
1A.
Right.
Right. So that at least, we know that. And
right.
Then send it back for sentencing without using the guidelines.
That would be perfectly appropriate, too. Although I would not go so far as to say that a court could not consider the guidelines. I think as a voluntary matter, they could consider the guidelines as something to think about because, as the point's been made, there's not much difference in terms of the factors that trial court is ultimately going to consider between OWI and a prohibited blood alcohol content conviction.
What if I told you that I believed as an article of faith that judges all over Wisconsin are religiously following these guidelines, irrespective of whether it's 1A or 1B that they're doing?
Mm-hmm.
That change the standing any?
I don't think it changes the standing on a constitutional issue, because what that addresses is the question of whether the judges are foregoing an exercise of discretion. And as the U.S. Supreme Court said in Chapman versus United States, there's no constitutional requirement for discretionary sentencing. That's strictly an issue of statute. And in Wisconsin, we have a tradition of using discretion for individualized sentencing. So to me, it's not an issue of constitutional standing, but it might be an issue of standing under state law to challenge the guidelines as effectively eliminating the discretion. Although even there, I think that the judge's decision about how to sentence, what level of authority to accord the guidelines, is itself an exercise of discretion.
Counsel, 2 points. Number one, if there's a statutory violation, doesn't that have the potential of raising a due process violation? That is, I was a constitutional question. That is, I was not sentenced in accord with the provisions of the statute, and therefore I wasn't given the process that I was due?
Well, perhaps in some scenario, what I don't think it does here. And that's in part because one thing that has not occurred in this case is a claim that the factors that are used in the guidelines are inappropriate factors for either 1B or 1A.
One of the problems I have with this case and the suggestion of sending it back for resentencing and say to the judges, look, 346-65-2MA only applies to 1B, so that's the way it is. We've got to be honest and forthright. And I think that if I'm a trial judge sitting in XYZ County, I say, okay, I understand that. I understand that. But your sentence, defendant, on 1A is 6 months. I've considered the nature of the offense, the rehabilitative needs of the defendant, and the protection of the public. Next case, State versus Jones. That's the way it's going to play out, isn't it?
I don't think so. I don't see any reason to believe that it would have to, and particularly if the court wants to go ahead and issue a decision in this case, the court can make clear that it's not sufficient to simply go down the grid and do it repeatedly, almost like a computer.
I suppose the way that it's really going to play out is this. Okay, I'm not going to find you guilty of OWI, I'm going to find you guilty of BAC. Okay, that's the way it's going to play out.
That I'm not sure about, because one of the problems with the record in this case is that we don't know how it got to a 1A rather than 1B. She was convicted under both statutes. And when you're convicted under both statutes, both the OWI and the prohibited bloody alcohol content, you can't sentence under both. There has to be an election at some
point.
What
are the ramifications to other cases of vacating this sentence and remanding for resentencing?
I'm not sure that there are any ramifications. It depends on how you go about vacating it. I think if you vacate it with some kind of opinion, then that opinion will have some effect on how other cases are decided, how other sentences are imposed. If you simply vacate it or dismiss the petition as improvidently granted, it offers no guidance to the courts, and the courts will work that out.
If we vacate it with an opinion that says that 346-65-2MA on its face applies to 1B and not 1A, ergo, we vacate and remand, what effect, if any, does that have on other cases?
I think what it might do in terms of how the DAs and the courts might actually decide which of the two statutes to use for the purpose of the sentencing, it might affect at the margins some decision by the prosecutor to dismiss 1A and go for 1B.
In the future. But, I mean, as I said, it'll
right.
play out. The way it's going to play out right. is everyone's going to get convicted under 1B rather than 1A. But what about past cases I'm talking about? Or cases that are still on review that have already been settled? How does this affect those?
Frankly, I don't think it affects it. I don't think there's any issue. I don't think that retroactivity would have an effect. We'd have State versus Smart, which deals with the constitutionality of the deadline.
Listen, State versus Smart, if my notes are correct, which doesn't mean they are, is before this Court, wasn't it?
There is a petition for review pending.
Depending on how this case goes, perhaps so goeth Smart.
That's very possible, Your Honor, yes. But at least based on what we have now, Smart is still the one that controls, and if this Court dismisses and vacates, I'm not sure that there'd be a reason for this Court to accept Smart.
But maybe we should send it down
summarily
decide it the way we do this one.
Possibly, yes.
Are the fact situations the same, namely charged with both,
I think
guilty
in Smart,
of both, and than convicted of only one?
I don't.
And convicted of 1A?
I think my recollection is that it was a conviction under 1A, so there may be a similar kind of issue there. I don't believe, when I went and looked at the briefs, I don't think there was any discussion about the applicability. So there may be, that may be in the petitions in front of this court. I don't know.
Why aren't you arguing, there wasn't discussion of this issue below either. Why aren't you arguing the waiver?
In terms of not having brought it up at all? Partly because I think it can be disposed of on the standing issue. I'm not real concerned about waiver. I think that Mr. Vetsner wanted to get this in front of the court to deal with the constitutional issue. I'm taking that at face value and going on the standing issue. I think that's the appropriate way to deal with it. And to the extent that the court wants to get at the merits, that on the merits, there is no due process or equal protection violation.
Both Smart and Jorgensen were decided by the same trial judge. Steve Ebert.
Okay.
I've got it in front of me.
Okay.
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, you're right.
Let's see.
You got two different trial courts.
Right.
Doing that.
In districts.
Two different districts, I think.
In two different districts.
Right.
And what's the similarity between the guidelines in the two districts?
That I don't know. I'm not sure what the similarities are between the guidelines.
Well, when you just look at Mr. Vetsner's brief here, similarity, there isn't a great deal of similarity between the districts.
That might very well, yes. I mean, some have.
A disparity.
There is disparity, and the question is whether that whether that violates due process and equal protection. And our position is that it doesn't, because the mandatory guidelines in this case are the guidelines that the legislature set forth in the penalty statute. And anything within that range does not violate due process or equal protection.
And the fourth judicial district at the bottom of there says mitigating factors, ability to pay, defendant's conduct since offense, including assessment and driving plan before conviction, consequences to defendant, consequences to victims, cooperation of the defendant, prosecutor's recommendation.
Right.
And yet that's not true in either the 8th District, if I'm reading it right, or the 5th District.
Okay.
Now, doesn't it bother you that in the 5th District, the guidelines for the fourth offense say 90 days to a year, and he got 210 days, or she got 210 days, whereas in the 4th District, there would have been 105 days, if I've read this right. Is that right?
Let's see. Fourth District.
It's in the last box.
That would be the recommended sentence, yes.
And in the 8th District, it would have been 150 days.
That's correct. That would be the recommendation.
And the difference in the districts might be one, maybe a few feet.
Correct.
On the county line. Might be in the middle of a community, the middle of a city, where one is in one county and the other, and that the counties are in different districts, right?
That's correct.
What kind of sense does that make?
In a constitutional sense or a political sense?
Constitutional.
The Constitution, once we get past the conviction itself, according to Chapman, due process equal protection is not a protection except for protected classes, in effect, impermissible. Protected classes like race, religion, that kind of thing. You can't sentence on those bases. From a constitutional point of view, I don't think it's any different from the fact that a crime is committed in one county that has a prosecutor that's kind of lenient on those crimes versus committing it across the county where a prosecutor or the judges might be more stringent. And the second thing is that from a constitutional basis, the issue is, from our point of view, whether the sentence simply falls within the range of the court or the legislature has authorized. And there's no question that these sentencing guidelines fit within that. If anything, they've kind of narrowed the range of opportunities or the range of considerations that particular judicial administrative districts think is the appropriate thing in the routine case. And there's nothing that restricts the prosecutor or the judge from deviating from the whatever the norms are they're suggesting in here.
I accept that. I accept that there's prosecutorial discretion in the system has more good with prosecutorial discretion than bad, and we accept that constitutionally. I accept that the judiciary, in an indeterminate sentencing system which we have, that judges, 250 judges around the state, are not necessarily going to exercise their discretion in the same manner, even given that the defendant is exactly the same. And no two defendants are ever exactly the same. But so the system has to bend for that. But why does the system have to bend on county or here district lines? Why, if you can't, here we have taxes. Court says, well, you can't have a different procedure for one county or area versus another county area. All taxpayers or to be treated the same across county lines. Well, you know, if I get that benefit when I'm a taxpayer, here we're dealing with liberty. Why can't I get that benefit in liberty, that all people across the state that are so charged are subject to the same sentencing guidelines? I mean, it would seem to me the cases are similar.
Well, it seems the way I look at it on behalf of the state is that the sentencing guideline is actually the statutory penalty provision which sets the full range that the legislature allows. And so long as a court, whether the legislature decides it's going to be at the county level or the judicial administrative district level, so long as the sentences are imposed that are within that range, there is no violation of the constitutional issue. There may be political reasons, there may be moral reasons, there may be ethical reasons why we don't like those things, or why we shouldn't want those things. But in terms of the question that's presented to this court, I think that the issue of whether it's constitutionally legitimate or whether it's statutorily legitimate, the answer has to be yes.
Well, why does the remedy in the tax case the answer have to be no? Well, or were we wrong in the tax case?
Well, I think that what the court was saying is that I don't recall the tax case in detail, but part of what I kind of speculated is that we also have a uniformity clause in terms of how taxation gets handled, and that when the legislature then says in one county we're going to have one procedure for evaluating that taxation, and in another county we're going to have a different valuation, and the only reason for creating that valuation is the population of the county. The population of the county doesn't necessarily have any relationship to uniformity of taxation. The quality or the number of pieces of property that have to be evaluated might have a rational relationship, but the mere population of the county doesn't. So I think it's appropriate to say we aren't going to allow disparity created like that in the context of taxation. In the context of drunk driving, I think a rational basis for these various guidelines, and again, I say that they are voluntary. They are in effect voluntary guidelines for the judges. If they decide they want to follow them, that in itself I think is an exercise of discretion. But when it comes to drunk driving, there are reasons why different areas might have different reasons for wanting to say, here in the typical case with these factors available, this is where we think sentences ought to kind of center around.
Mr. Wren,
yes.
Let me ask you this in relation to the argument that was made by opposing counsel. Let's get off the constitutional issue for a minute and look at the position taken that these guidelines do not meet the requirements of the statute. The statute says what should be occurring is a listing, if you will, of mitigating and aggravating circumstances, not what should be occurring is 210 days, 150 days, 105 days. how do you answer the argument that the guidelines themselves are not in accordance with the statute and what the statute requires?
Well, the statute, I think, sets a minimum of what the chief administrative judge does. It says that the chief administrative judge shall create these guidelines based on aggravating and mitigating factors. What's happened in the guidelines is that the chief judges have gone beyond that and added on tables that make recommended links between factors and suggested sentences.
Does that violate the statute?
I don't think it violates the statute. I don't think there's any restriction on the judges doing that. And I don't think that necessarily the legislature could have restricted the judges from doing that without perhaps running into a separation of powers problem. I mean, that's not something we're debating, and that hasn't been briefed by any means. But I don't think that there's any real difference between what's happened in these cases and with the legislature saying do it, as opposed to what, say, the chief judge gets together with various judges from in a district, says, we need to deal with some sentencing guidelines. Let's create them voluntarily. And so what they've done is they've done what the statute requires and then voluntarily gone beyond and provided some additional linkage that I don't think itself violates the Constitution or the statute.
Are the guidelines, is the grid itself sufficient to comply with the mandate of the statute? That is, the grid sets forth an ever-increasing BAC as an ever-increasing aggravation of the situation, and an ever-increasing number of offense as an ever-increasing aggravation of the situation. The mirror is, if it's a smaller offense, it's mitigating. Is the grid in and of itself, does the grid in and of itself constitute compliance with the statute?
I believe it does for a couple of reasons. One is that the grid has as one of its axes some aggravating or mitigating factors. You have one part of the grid is for basically no drive. There's no bad driving or anything like that. Another part of the grid, at least in District 5, has bad driving or an accident or something like that.
Okay, let's say the grid doesn't have that. It's just a number of offenses, and you match it up with the BAC. Is that sufficient to meet the mandates of the statute?
If you have a guideline or a grid, and there's no accompanying list of any sort of aggravating or mitigating circumstances, then I think there's a problem with those guidelines, because the guideline requires aggravating and mitigating circumstances or factors. It does not require linking them with any kind of sentencing guidelines.
So just to make sure I understand your answer, if a grid has just BAC on one axis and number of offense meeting it on another axis, and no other separate listing of mitigating or aggravating factors, that would violate the mandate of the statute.
I want to be careful on this, because I don't think it has to be a separate listing. The listing can be integrated into the grid itself,
okay,
which is what District 5 has done.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Let me rephrase that. And if there is no other aggravating or mitigating factor set forth in the guidelines, whether it be in a separate list or on the grid itself, that just consideration of BAC and number of offenses, that consideration would be insufficient under the statute.
I think that would be insufficient to comply with the statutory requirement to create these guidelines based on the factors. That doesn't necessarily mean, from my point of view, that a sentence would be invalid if the rest of the record shows the court, in fact, used discretion to decide on factors independent of whether they're in the grid or not, and then, based on all those considerations, decides that the sentence shown in the grid is appropriate.
Let me assume a world like this exists, and let me call it the 12th Judicial District. And let me assume that it's primarily a district made up of one and two and three judge counties. And let me assume that one of the reasons that they use the guidelines is to prevent substitution of judges. In other words, if I'm going to go, it's a one-judge county, and the judge there follows the guideline. If I come in as a visiting judge, and if I give less of a sentence than the guideline indicates, there are going to be increased substitutions on the resident judge on OWI cases. And so the judges in this 12th Judicial District all agree, hey, we're going to follow the guidelines because otherwise we're going to be traveling hither and yon. How does that play out in your world of the judges considering all of the elements and reflecting upon the individual nature of the offense and the rehabilitative needs of the defendants? And in the world that you describe, it can consider the guidelines, but you're not limited to them, and you don't have to rely on them, but only a little bit. Now, how does my make-believe world, would that comply with the law, both statutorily and constitutionally, employing the sentencing scheme?
Well, I think so long as the guidelines themselves comply with the statute, it complies with the statute. The application of it by the courts is something that's independent of the statute, and that, I think, has to be reviewed separately from the question of whether the guidelines themselves comply with what the legislature wanted the chief judge to do. From a constitutional point of view, again, I don't think that there's a constitutional problem with the judges getting together, certainly a U.S. constitutional problem, I don't think even a state constitutional problem, with the judges getting together and basically saying, we're going to try to be uniform. The motivation may be something that this court might not like, but in terms of the constitutionality of in terms of due process or equal protection, I don't think it creates a problem. Again, Chapman, I come back to Chapman, which pretty much sets the standard. They say that individualized sentencing is not a constitutional obligation under the U.S. Constitution. I don't think it's an obligation under the state constitution. It's an issue in terms of the state's tradition of allowing judges' discretion. And if the judges choose not to exercise discretion, it should be reviewed under the failure to exercise discretion, not under a constitutional or statutory standard of whether the guidelines complied themselves. I think they're two separate questions that get dealt with.
Mr. Wren, if you would clarify for me, please, your alternate standing arguments. As I understood them, you are arguing that the defendant here does have standing to raise the statutory argument. In other words, she can argue that I was sentenced pursuant to guidelines mandated by a statute that applies to BAC offenses only, not to the OWI offense upon which I was convicted. But then she doesn't have standing to assert the constitutional challenge to the guidelines. But then I heard you argue later on in your argument that even in the absence of statutory authority to use these guidelines to sentence on an OWI offense, the trial court would have inherent authority to use them on a permissive basis, or that the districts would have inherent authority to adopt them for application to OWI offenses, even though the statute only says they apply to BAC offenses. So if that's the case, and that's in fact what happened here, then doesn't she have standing to raise the constitutional argument?
I'm not sure about the constitutional argument. I guess I must be missing a link there.
Constitutional argument about due process and equal protection. That the use of the guidelines violates due process and equal protection.
But I don't think they do violate.
No, I understand that. That's the bottom line question. Yeah, I was asking about standing.
But I don't think that the decision to use them or not use them is a constitutional issue. I think it goes strictly to the statutory question. And I think even there it's a very narrow kind of statutory issue, that her argument might be, and this is the way I'm interpreting it, that she would have gotten a different and more lenient sentence had the court not considered these guidelines that it should, that under the statute it should not have considered. I think the implicit in her argument is the idea that the courts, the trial court had a misunderstanding of its legal obligation to consider the guidelines, and that that is a, that, that is a statutory violation, it's not a constitutional violation. So our position is, well, to the extent that might be a problem, we'll concede that that, that that she has standing to go back and ask the judge either to resentence or to explain that the sentence wouldn't, that the sentence would have been the same even without the guidelines. But it, it, to me, it doesn't sort of leak over into a constitutional challenge. Because again, I think there, I guess I'm not seeing.
But not because of a lack of standing, only because of the resolution of the statutory issue.
Well,
in terms of that resolution producing a remand for resentencing.
Yeah. Well, under the constitutional standard for standing, as I understand it, is that, and I take this out of basically Schwitte, where the you have to have a constitutional violation associated with whatever has gone on. I don't think there's a constitutional violation.
Well, she was sentenced under the guidelines, was she not?
Right.
And so she's been aggrieved by the use of those guidelines, whether because of a statutory violation or because it violated her rights to due process and equal protection. So she's got standing
on either one. I see the point you're making. Yes, on that standard, there's an arguable constitutional
right. So we might not get to the constitutional argument
right.
because of the resolution of a statutory yeah. argument, but that doesn't mean yeah. she doesn't have standing.
I understand your point. I've been focusing mainly on the idea that that we deal with discretion and individualized sentencing, and that individualized sentencing is not a constitutionally required obligation of the court. If the court has no further questions, I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Wren. Mr. Vetzner, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. We've referred to the quote-unquote statutory argument. Let me make clear there are two separate statutory arguments. The statutory argument that I've been pursuing is that the statute in question does not authorize the creation of recommended or proposed or presumptive sentences. And I think it's very important that in response to a question from Justice Crooks, the state has conceded that the statute does not authorize this. What the state's argued is that somehow Justice Sykes characterized it as an inherent power, characterize the state's argument as being some type of inherent power. I don't know where an administrative judge in his or her capacity as an administrative judge has any inherent power. The creation of the powers of administrative judges is derived from this court, from the Supreme Court rules. I think if this court were to accept the state's argument here, to go back to our new proposed felony guidelines or trial guidelines, what's to prevent the chief administrative judge in each district to say, well, we've only got these experimental guidelines for 12 felonies. We've got all these other felonies. I'm going to come along and I'm going to develop some proposed sentences for all the other felonies that the Sentencing Commission hasn't gotten to. There isn't any inherent power. There's no authority for the administrative judges to do this absent a directive from this court or absent some express directive from the legislature, and the state has conceded that the legislature did not provide that authority. In regard to the constitutional argument, let me go to the constitutional argument before I come back to the other statutory argument. Without belaboring this point, if we were to assume hypothetically that the legislature had created a statutory framework that says, for example, for fourth offense, operating while intoxicated, if the offense occurs in a county that contains a city that's the capital of the state, the penalty is 7 months in jail. However, if it occurs in another county that's more than 100 miles away from the capital of the state, the offense is punishable by 150 days in jail or 105 days in jail. Those were the penalties in the 4th and 8th administrative districts. I would submit that that would be unconstitutional. If the court doesn't buy that argument, that under that hypothetical, that it's unconstitutional, then you should reject my constitutional argument. If you accept that under that hypothetical, that we have a constitutional problem, then the question is, how different is that hypothetical from the reality of the sentencing guidelines? Admittedly, it's not the same, it's not mandatory, but it's very much different from the simple exercise of judicial discretion in deciding on an individual case what the sentence should be, and it's certainly much different than a prosecutor's individualized discretion in a particular case deciding how to charge the defendant. I would submit that where we have formalized guidelines and where those guidelines have been utilized, that we have a constitutional violation. Now the other statutory argument, this question about whether or not the guidelines apply to operating under the influence as opposed to just operating with a prohibited blood alcohol content. This is the state's argument rather than my argument. And admittedly, I'm kind of walking a close line here, as I explained before. What troubles me is the proposal that this court would say, that there's no standing because this was an under-the-influence conviction as opposed to a BAC, we're going to remand this back where the court can consider the guideline but not sentence under the guideline. Let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose the judge in this case had said, I'm going to sentence you to 7 months in jail, and one of the things I'm considering in imposing this sentence is that you don't go to church. Do I have standing to raise a First Amendment issue? Do we say I don't have standing because the judge only considered whether or not my client went to church or not? There's no guideline, there's no grid that says church 7 months, no church 12 months. It's a factor that's been used in sentencing. If this court is going to send this back and say that the trial judge can consider the guidelines, it should only do that after resolving both the constitutional issue and the other statutory issue. If the court concludes that the guidelines are constitutional, and if the court concludes that the guidelines are in compliance with the statute, even though the state's already conceded that they're not, then it would be appropriate to remand it back for resentencing in consideration of the guideline. Because I argue that those circumstances have not been complied with. It violates the Constitution. It violates the statute. I would submit this court should vacate for resentencing, but vacate for resentencing without consideration of any guideline, and the court should declare that these guidelines are invalid. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vetzner, and thank you, Mr. Wren, for your argument today on district sentencing guidelines. And that concludes our hearing on 01-2690 State v. Jorgensen. The students will remain here for a discussion of the court's procedures with Justice Prosser. They will be joined by other students, and Justice Prosser will return in just a few moments. We are in recess until 1:45.
Enjoy it. Thank you.